Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Konser, and today I'm visiting the Jordan Schnitzer Museum of Art at the University of Oregon, which is hosting the exhibition The Art of the News, all about comics journalism. I'm joined by two distinguished professors. Catherine Kelp Stebbins is Associate Director of the Comics Studies Program at the UO. She's also affiliated faculty in New Media and Culture, as well as Women's Studies. Benjamin Saunders is the founder and director of the undergraduate minor in Comics and Cartoon Studies at the UO. He started out lecturing on the literature of the English Renaissance, which we're definitely going to ask him about. And we're welcoming back to the show Sarah Merck. Sarah is contributing editor at the graphic journalism website The Nib, as well as digital engagement producer for Reveal at the Center for Investigative Journalism. Kate and Ben, welcome to Words and Pictures.
Thank you so much for having us on the show. And I'm just so delighted that we get to talk about the art of the news and talk with one of the most incredible contributors, Sarah Merck, who's just been invaluable for the exhibition.
Yes, Sarah, great to talk with you again.
Yeah, I'm so happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'm glad to be here too, by the way.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind all of our listeners that we are currently in the midst of KBOO's all-important end-of-the-year membership drive. We hope that you've been enjoying our special holiday programming and that you'll take a moment to become a member of KBOO. Because we're still being cautious and not yet opening up our studios, we don't have volunteers in the station to take your calls right now, but you can show your support by giving online, kboo.fm. Or text KBOO to 44321. KBOO is one of the very last media outlets that still brings you local and independent news, music, and public affairs. We've been doing this here in Portland for over half a century. And this program has been coming to you for 18 years now, inviting important cultural figures into the studio and venturing out to events that might fly beneath the radar of the big media monoliths. So yes, you can support this very special programming today by going online to kboo.fm/give, or simply text KBOO to 44321. And if you prefer to go analog, we're always happy to receive a contribution in the mail. The address of the station is 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. So Kate, this exhibit, The Art of the News, this is really your project.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely something that I've been wanting to do since I first came to University of Oregon in 2018. And I think I was shocked with the alacrity with which it came together. And more importantly, just the tremendous support that we were able to get for the show and the number of artists who all said yes. I have to say, I know Ben had many a frantic call or email from me, like wondering how I could pitch this. And he just reassured me, like, tell them about it and they will come. And it absolutely happened. So it's been an incredible experience just in terms of putting together a show that brings artists from all over the world into a single exhibition and artists who work in a variety of different media. We have watercolor artists, we have people who work in virtual reality, and then all manner of in between who are covering topics that, again, span the globe. People looking at, you know, riots in India, as well as looking at migrant crises in Lebanon and Malta, and then people like Sarah who are going down and looking at the current situation at Guantanamo Bay or at wealth inequity here in the US during the pandemic. So it's been a really amazing experience of really just having everyone want to be a part of it and then getting everyone here to actually talk about it as well.
Well, you mentioned the global reach of comics journalism, and you have very well-known folks such as Joe Sacco and Sarah Glidden here, but the show also introduces us to a number of artists and writers who work outside the US. There's Victoria Lomasko from Russia, Gerardo Alba from Mexico, Tracy Chawan, Yazan Al-Sadi, and Omar Curry from Lebanon.
Yeah, and don't forget Jesus Cosio from Peru as well. And Jesus actually was able to come in for the symposium, which was, I think, the longest distance. Dan Archer came from London, so they both flew all the way to Eugene in order to talk about their artwork, and they were both willing to lend us their work for the show. So it's been a really incredible experience just to work with people who are coming from really diverse perspectives and really different positions in terms of the way that the news is impacting them.
Well, you're not just putting comics up in the walls of the museum. You're also showing the public the methodology behind comics journalism, the interviews, the research, the editing and collaboration.
Yeah, I mean, I'll actually pass this off to Sarah just because I often quote her. Sarah specifically during an interview with my students said that all comics creation is an act of collaboration and that there are different ways that this collaboration takes place and different actors that are part of these collaborations. But I think Sarah can speak to the real importance and the kind of invaluable work that comics artists do, not just with each other, but with editors, with sources, and then with their readers.
Yeah, I just say that all comics is collaboration because even if you're like a lone wolf kind of artist working in your home, you're still collaborating with a publisher who's putting out your work or with an editor who's working on it. And I always think of artists as collaborating with their audience. You know, you're thinking about who's going to be reading your work and what it's going to mean to them and how it'll be interpreted as you're writing and drawing. I love comics for that reason, that it's something where I can take my ideas and hand them off to somebody else and they'll make them so, so much better throughout the process of working on it. And, you know, a lot of comics you see published now, there might be one person writing it, one person drawing it, one person coloring it, one person lettering it, plus somebody else laying it out and designing it. So it's a whole team behind a comic. It's never just one person, which is why I always think it's weird to see just one name on the cover of a graphic novel when it's a whole team working on it.
Well, Sarah, let's talk about a project that really exemplifies what you're talking about, and it's featured prominently in The Art of the News, and that's the book Guantanamo Voices.
Yeah, so with Guantanamo Voices, it's a nonfiction graphic narrative. So real life stories told in comics. And for the book, I interviewed 10 different people who have spent time at the prison at Guantanamo Bay in different capacities. So people in the military, former prisoners, and just people from sort of all walks of life who have spent time there. And then I had 10 different artists illustrate their stories. So each chapter in the book is a different voice, and it's also a different visual voice. It's a different person drawing the chapter. And for me, that was really important to have it feel like there's sort of like a chorus of people working on this issue, you know, artists from all around the world whose work is featured in this book, as well as it's important logistically for the reader to feel like each chapter is really different than the one previously. You know, people have different perspectives, they have different experiences. And as you're reading through the book, you get those different feelings. It also made it possible for us to do the book very quickly. You know, I wrote the book in 6 months and the artists did the artwork in 6 months. So the book was able to come out in a year, which is really fast for like a 200-page graphic novel. And that was important to us because we wanted to get it out before the 2020 election.
So we're talking about Camp X-Ray on Guantanamo Yep. Bay in Cuba. And this is, it's not quite a dark site, but it's certainly a place that our government doesn't like to talk much about. So I can't imagine that the process of getting interviews with the people that you talked to was a smooth one.
It actually went okay. The first thing I did in researching the book was reading every book about Guantanamo Bay, so which is like 15 books. And from that, I found the people that I wanted to talk to, some of whom had written memoirs, some of whom had written other books, and some of them were just quoted in these stories. There's also a group of former prisoners of Guantanamo Bay who have formed their own advocacy nonprofit in the United Kingdom. That's called CAGE. And there's a group that also works with former prisoners of the US War on Terror called REPRIEVE. So between those two groups, the sort of nonprofit formed by former prisoners called CAGE and REPRIEVE, the legal advocacy group, I was able to get connected with former prisoners who were like up for talking about their story because it is really traumatic, really terrible stuff. So I want to talk to people who were definitely up for sharing their story with me, rather than sort of prying and kind of forcing someone to talk to me. So that was the inroad for how I talked to those people who, yeah, as you mentioned, the US government has told us a story about Guantanamo, which is that, you know, don't think about it. First of all, it's trying to make it an invisible place that isn't part of our consciousness, even though it's been open for 20 years, as well as a place that we shouldn't care about because the people who are imprisoned there, the government says, are the worst of the worst terrorists in the world, and we shouldn't care what happens to them. So it was really important for me to try and humanize their stories with this book and present them as real people who have, you know, real dreams and ideas and are humans in the world who we should care about just like anybody else.
Well, with all of that in mind, how did you go about choosing the artists that would participate in this?
Yeah, that's a really, really difficult question because I easily could have filled 100 exhibitions with everyone whose work would have been meaningful and beautiful and worthy of representation in the show. But I think thinking about the Art of the New specifically, I really wanted this show to showcase a very broad and diverse range of techniques and methodologies, as well as approaches to storytelling. So the way that each one of the artists went about creating a specific journalistic account of what it was that they were reporting on, that was important to me. And showing the different ways that people do that was really important. But then I would say, similarly, going back to part of what Sarah said, the through line that to me unites all of the work in this particular show is really the sort of responsibility that you can see in the work of each artist, and that concept of collaborating not only with your potential readers or the people who are visiting the museum, but actually with the subjects. Every one of the artists in this show is deeply committed to doing justice to the stories of people like those that Sarah's describing, whose stories are often unheard or whose voices are often unamplified. And so I really wanted to give a different sort of perspective on what the news could be if you were focusing on people who are telling these stories that we don't hear, like the story of Camp X-Ray, or like the story that Joe Sacco tells in Paying the Land, of the Dene people of Northwest Canada who have basically been victims of attempted cultural genocide, or like the story of victims of Colombian political violence or human trafficking in Nepal that Dan Archer is telling, or like people who have had their entire educational trajectory disrupted through the Syrian refugee crisis, like Andy Warner is talking about. So these are stories that I felt really needed to be told. That said, it can be a sort of heavy show. So I tried to also make sure that we were doing things so that the viewer had a sort of self-care as they were going through the gallery space and getting a sense of the beauty of the work as well, and the real love that goes into every single page that every one of these artists produced. I don't know, Ben, do you want to speak also to the selection process?
I think the show does a remarkable job of educating without bludgeoning. And I would attribute that primarily to not just Kate's selection of work, but one of the more interesting things about comics journalism itself, as opposed to other kinds of journalism. One of the reasons that it is such an interesting combination of genre and medium. Often when I respond to the regular news, you know, the 24-hour news cycle, when I hear about something horrible happening and I go numb, you know, the process is very quick. You hear something awful and you kind of shut down. And one of the really remarkable things about, I mean, let's just take, for example, Joe Sacco's work in Paying the Land. I had in the last year had heard headline news stories about the horrors of the residential school system and the discovery of these unmarked graves and so on. And the difference between encountering that kind of story and that kind of information in the quote unquote traditional news versus encountering the historical information about the residential school system in Joe's work, they are like universes apart, even though it's ultimately the same kind of content. I think that's fascinating. It's a question that emerges in some ways out of Joe's willingness to do the opposite of whatever, you know, fast food news would be. There's something really slow cooked about the process. 2 years of research and then 3 years to actually produce the book. And we are carefully introduced to the individuals who are his primary research subjects and learn about them as people and about their lives before we get into some of the what would be considered the sort of the newsworthy elements, whether it's the stories about resource extraction or the residential schools, so that we encounter people as people before they then become elements of a larger news story. And it just changes the way, in some ways it's heavier, it's more traumatizing in some ways, I suppose, because you feel for people rather than thinking of them purely as statistics. But on the other hand, it makes it easier to absorb the information and in some ways easier to care. It precludes that sort of shutting down. This leads to a question I actually have, which came out of what you were just saying for Sarah, actually, because Sarah, I didn't realize until you said just now that part of the goal had been to get Guantanamo Voices out ahead of the last election. And this reminded me of something that Joe said over the weekend that he said a few times, I think, which is that you don't break the news in comics journalism because it just takes so long. But you're definitely working with a different kind of model. There's a desire there to be, if not breaking the news, then at the very least timely. So I just wanted to invite you to talk a bit more about that tension between the labor-intensive requirements of comics journalism to produce a different kind of news and that desire to nonetheless be timely.
Yeah, well, I think of comics as a way to create cultural change. So by cultural change, I mean the stories that we tell about ourselves and our society and things in the world. And those stories change really slowly. You kind of have to plant a seed and see what grows. It's not something that you can change by just telling somebody a fact. Mm-hmm. You have to tell a story that people connect with emotionally and that they think about for a long time and that starts to shape the way that they see the world. So with Guantanamo, the dominant narrative about the prison has been set very effectively for many years by the US government, which has told this story that the prison is a safe, humane, and legal place that's necessary to protect American lives. And countering that myth is very difficult because it's so deeply rooted in our culture already because the government has been telling it for a long time. And so with, you know, changing that narrative that we're telling about this place and the people who are imprisoned there and what we as Americans have done is like the way to change the way that we understand the prison and the people who are there. And I think that comics are a really good way for doing that because you can actually show people's lives. You can show people's experiences. And as you mentioned, Ben, you're not bludgeoning people over the head with facts. It's educational, but it's educational in a way that I think people find really engaging and accessible. So, you know, there's a dozen books written about Guantanamo already, mm-hmm. But a lot of people don't pick them up because they're pretty dense prose books. They don't see a way into that. Mm-hmm. Unless you're somebody who already cares about this issue, you're not going to go seek that out. Mm-hmm. But with a comic, you know, I'll pick up a comic on any topic, really, you know, because I'm like, oh, this is interesting. And at the very least, like, I'm drawn in by the artwork. And so I think that was, for me, an important way to tell the story of Guantanamo, to be like, I can tell this in a way that brings people in and makes it really easy to understand and accessible, and also just makes it feel like something we can face. You know, what we've done there is so terrible that there's never really like a good time to talk about it. People kind of shut down when you start bringing up issues like war crimes or torture. And so telling the story in a way that feels possible really is what comics can do, I think, where it makes people think, okay, I can pick up this book and I can read it and I can keep reading it and I can hear these stories and then those will shape my mind. But yeah, I wanted to get it out before the 2020 election, not because I have any idea that it will like immediately and directly impact policy. So for example, it's not like I released this book and then the next day President Biden was like, I'm going to close Guantanamo Bay. Right. But what I'm hoping to do is that people read the book and then that shapes their understanding of what we've done and what we continue to do. And that helps in the long term shape both policies on the federal level and just people's ideas about themselves and our history and our present. And so I do hope that it can be part of like a movement to close Guantanamo Bay and to like seek justice and reparations for what we've done there. And then it can also shape people's understanding of Islamophobia and racism and xenophobia and 9/11, all of those things.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Konser. And today we're visiting the Jordan Schnitzer Museum of Art at the University of Oregon, which is hosting the exhibition, The Art of the News. We're joined by comics studies professors Catherine Kelp-Stebbins and Benjamin Saunders, and by Sarah Merck, contributing editor at the graphic journalism website, The Nib. Before we get back to the conversation, I'd like to take a moment to remind our listeners that KBOO is in the midst of our end-of-the-year membership drive, now through December 31st. We hope that you've been enjoying our special holiday programming and that you'll take a moment to become a member of KBOO. Our studios are still closed to phone volunteers, but we have all sorts of options for donating. If you'd like to pledge on the web, you can visit kboo.fm/give. You can also text KBOO to 44321. And if you prefer to go analog, we're always happy to receive a contribution in the mail. The address of the station is 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Again, the webpage is kboo.fm/give. On your mobile device, you can text KBOO to 44321. And of course, you can reach us by mail at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. And now let's talk some more with our guests. Well, here's a subject that comes up whenever people talk about journalism of any type: subjectivity, implicit bias. As far as this exhibition goes, when it comes to comics journalism, you're out to tackle it head on.
Yeah, it was really instructive and just very exciting getting to talk with all of the artists this summer. My undergraduate students from the comic studies minor actually conducted one-on-one interviews with every artist featured in the show. So we got to talk a lot about what objectivity means and why it's used and weaponized in the way that it is. And I think to me, the clearest statement about it actually came from Yazan Al-Sadi, who said, objectivity is the position of those who are not being directly affected, and it is a position of power. Because if you're not affected, it's easy to be objective and to claim some sort of exemption from the events that you're recording. But if you yourself are actually a part of what is happening, or if you feel any sort of human compassion, it's very hard to approach human rights atrocities with this sort of distance or some sense that you're not involved in any way, shape, or form when you're there listening to people tell you about the worst days of their lives. And so I really appreciate the range of approaches to kind of dismantling the myth of objectivity. A lot of the artists, I mean, Ben Passmore also talks about how often he's writing from the protest. He's not writing about the protest. He's in the protest because it is very important to him that if the KKK is in town, he is out there marching against the KKK. And so for him, this isn't something where he can just sit back and write about protesters. He's in the mix and like wants to show that in his comics, because for him, leaning into your point of view is actually a way of being honest about your point of view and about your relation to those in power and those dispossessed of power.
Yeah, I think objectivity is fake because as an author, you're always writing from your own perspectives, including what time you're alive in history, in addition to like your race and gender, your religion, your background. So you always bring those kinds of perspectives to your writing, and it's the lens through which you filter what's important. Who should I talk to? What kind of stories do I want to tell? So what to me is much more important is being transparent, relevant, and accurate. So rather than trying to be objective, which means like trying to saying I'm totally removed from this situation, I'm not being affected by what's happening at all, saying here's who I am and here's what I'm writing about. And so comics is a great medium for being transparent as a journalist, because Joe Sacco started this method of inserting yourself as the writer into the comic. So in his comics, you actually see him as the reporter going around talking to people and how he's responding in the moment. And that really inspired me and a lot of other comics journalists to insert ourselves in the work as well, to show the process of reporting in the comic. So in a lot of comics journalism that's in the show and elsewhere, and in my work, like people draw themselves into the comic being like, here's me asking these questions and considering these responses. And to me, that's really cool to see, to be able to be like, yeah, here's the person making this. We're not pretending this is some like robot behind a screen. This is a real human. And here's what they're thinking about as they're going through this process.
Yeah. And I think there may be something, again, really inherent about the comics medium that encourages a certain more interesting take on the question of what it means to be subjective. Most of the cartoonists in the show are writer artists. They're people who both write and draw the material. And there is something about that auteurist quality to the medium that's valuable because it helps to foreground the problem of objectivity, which you've been talking about, essentially, that it can be quite a pernicious illusion. You know, it's a view from somewhere that is pretending to be a view from nowhere. And that when you have a story told through comics, and particularly a story told by a singular writer artist, what you have is the definition of a subjective viewpoint, and in some ways a reminder of the inevitable subjectivity of our perception. You know, the view is always from somewhere.
I think, Ben, that everything you're saying is really important because, again, when it comes to comics journalism, you have the direct connection of the eye and the hand of the producer. So you're no longer talking about a shutter and an aperture and the click of a button, or even, you know, something that is ultimately fed through a word processing engine. You're talking about, and I know Sarah and I both love this, what Ben Passmore calls the closest thing to seeing through someone else's eyes, because you're actually watching what their body makes as they're witnessing something visually. And then I think there are two other aspects to the way that the show deconstructs objectivity, the first of which would simply be the types of stories people are telling. As Yazan Al-Sadi and Omar Khoury both talk about, these are stories of people who are not in power, because those stories don't get told that often. And Joe Sacco has said that he doesn't feel responsible for making apologetics for the powerful. He wants to go out and tell stories that aren't otherwise being told. And so when you look at the sorts of people who are on the wall, what you're seeing are people that you don't often see in what we might consider to be more mainstream news. They're not celebrities.
Kate, you were talking about two very different styles. First off, Joe Sacco, whose reportage can be a bitter pill sometimes. He's going into war zones. He's going into ruined communities. And then on the other hand, you mentioned Ben Passmore, whose stuff has more of a deft touch. I mean, there's crazy stuff going on, but he's embracing the absurdity in his style. I think another person in that vein who's included in the exhibition is Victoria Lomasco, whose coverage of the Russian punk rock pranksters Pussy Riot has a real upstart vibe to it. It has a real, almost hopeful vibe to it.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think that what I hope for the show is that it really gives you a broad range of the way that the very use of the comics page can be so radically different depending on the artist and depending on the topic. And certainly if you're looking at Vika's work, Victoria Lomasco, actually, she considers herself and what she does graphic reportage. And she thinks of herself as a graphic reporter, but she's often drawing in the moment and live drawing things that are going on around her. And so you get a certain kind of vivacity to her own depictions of protests that she's documenting. And she is going to great risk to her own physical well-being in order to document these things. So even if there is a certain kind of hopefulness, there's also a great amount of risk involved in what she's doing, which I think comes through in the urgency of her work as well. Another person, though, that I would throw into your list would definitely be Gerardo Alba, who talks a lot about the way that he uses his style, which he calls like very cartoony, as a way to kind of immediately bridge what people otherwise perceive as radical differences between themselves and others. He's writing a lot about US-Mexican and also US Central and South American relations and various issues at the US-Mexican border. And so you already have so much baggage in terms of the racist rhetoric that has been spewed in this country. So to overcome that, I think Gerardo is often using this really playful sort of caricature style that I find really effective. And it's really disarming, and it gets you to immediately be engaged with stories that, going back to what Ben was saying, you might otherwise just kind of feel numb to or actually really foreign from. And so I really appreciate that technique of just getting people excited about what they're reading until they realize they're actually reading about, you know, the horrors of ICE detention centers.
It's a gamble, right? I mean, it's a risk. This reminds me of something that Ben Passmore said during the artist symposium about reaching out to the family member of a victim of police violence and introducing himself as a comics journalist and getting the response of something like, "So what, this is a joke to you? Is that what you think?" Which is obviously a misunderstanding of his intentions and of the aims of a comics journalist of the kinds that we have in the show, but is also a reminder, what Gerardo does in his own work is a reminder that actually you can lean into some of these associations that people have with the medium and the association of the medium with essentially younger readers. There's a certain sort of lightness of tone or a lean clear style or a kind of rubber boned, bouncy, kinetic cartooniness, which can be ironically repurposed or produce a deliberate kind of cognitive dissonance in terms of the material that you're then looking at. And I do think actually Victoria Lomasco is really good at this. There's a repurposing here, in other words, of a traditional visual cartoonist's vocabulary that, again, this is something that just through putting this show together and bringing this particular group of artists together, Kate has educated me about, and that the show will teach audiences about if they're able to come and see it. And now might not be a bad idea to remind people that it will be there until January 16th so that people can indeed come and see some of these things for themselves. But that repurposing of the medium is, it's at once a risk and can feel deliberately cognitively dissonant. And on the other hand, I think it's tremendously powerful.
When people walk into the exhibition, there's a tableau that's right there at the entryway. And it's a little bit of an introduction to comics journalism. And it mentions Thomas Nast, who was an editorial cartoonist at the turn of the century from the 19th to 20th century. And illustrated stories were actually a big part of journalism in the 19th century before photography became as mobile as it would be later.
It was interesting. People would hear the phrase comics journalism and they would assume actually that we were talking about something like illustrated news or the political cartoon, the editorial cartoon. And there is a tradition here, but there is also, I think, a real break from those older sources. The kinds of work that are exhibited in the show, it's not breaking news, but neither is it opinion, which is, again, subtle, because when we're just talking about how comics journalists are not afraid to speak from a subjective position, but that's very different from writing an opinion piece and accompanying it with an editorial cartoon. There's a difference between situating the journalist within the process of news gathering and taking a particular ideological perspective. These things are quite different. And so just having people understand that this thing called comics journalism is really in some ways a distant cousin of these older forms of using illustration and cartooning in newspapers. This is not editorial cartooning, and that's the first thing we would sort of have to disabuse people of when trying to promote the show. And again, this is not to knock editorial cartoonists. You know, I love that stuff. And I'd go to see a show on Thomas Nast tomorrow. You know, I mean, it's exciting material. And it's fascinating material. I actually think the time has probably come. We need a good Thomas Nast show right now. But what the artists represented in this show that Kate has put together are doing is really something quite different. It's closer in spirit to the in-depth extended documentary film. And even then, the analogy isn't quite right, because a lot of documentary movies insist on keeping the documentary maker behind the camera. But it's closer in spirit to that kind of exercise, I think, than it is to any form of traditional news illustration.
Yet to me, what the difference feels like is that comics journalists are telling real life stories. So you can be a great editorial cartoonist, and what you're doing is making pointed satire, which is like creating a joke, which is a work of fiction about a current political or personal situation, versus comics journalists are telling real life stories, some of which are very funny and some of which are very pointed and political, but it's like drawn from real life. Mm-hmm. That's how I always try to explain the difference. Though I did recently have someone like comment, because I post all my comics on Instagram, and they said, "Oh, I love your memes. I love the memes you make." Oh, I don't think of them that way, but I do think that there's like a generation of like younger people making memes to serve a lot of the same points that editorial cartoons do, you know, combining images and text to make a really pointed joke or political commentary, you know, but it's with like bad fonts and intentionally janky Photoshop versus drawing it by hand. And right. So that to me was really funny, of being like, wow, I've never really thought of the crossover between political comics and memes before, but I think for, in a lot of ways, they can serve the same kind of purpose for the creator and for the audience.
Yeah. You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Konser. And today we're visiting the Jordan Schnitzer Museum of Art at the University of Oregon, which is hosting the exhibition, The Art of the News. We're joined by comics studies professors Catherine Kelp-Stebbins and Benjamin Saunders, and by Sarah Merck, contributing editor at the graphic journalism website, The Nib. Before we get back to the conversation, I'd like to take a moment to remind our listeners that KBOO is in the midst of our end-of-the-year membership drive, now through December 31st. We hope that you've been enjoying our special holiday programming and that you'll take a moment to become a member of KBOO. Our studios are still closed to phone volunteers, but we have all sorts of options for donating. If you'd like to pledge on the web, you can visit kboo.fm/give. You can also text KBOO to 44321. And if you prefer to go analog, we're always happy to receive a contribution in the mail. The address of the station is 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Again, the webpage is kboo.fm/give. On your mobile device, you can text KBOO to 44321. And of course, you can reach us by mail at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Ben, you wrote a book back in 2007 for Harvard University Press, an analysis of the 17th century English poet John Donne. It's called,
I did do that.
It's called Desiring Donne, Poetry, Sexuality, Interpretation. A person could be forgiven for thinking you were brought over from the old country to be the face of classic liberal arts education here.
I probably had more success here because of the residual remainder of my accent, perhaps, and people imagining that somehow I'm more intelligent than I am because of the tortured nature of my vowels. Yeah, to be honest, I would say that there's not as big a jump as you might imagine between thinking a lot about poetry and thinking a lot about comics. Actually, in terms of verbal artifacts and print literature, what poems share with comics is the fact that you can see the whole thing on a page, and you are also going to read linearly. So if you think about the unit of the line and the function of the line and the way that works on a page, and then if you think about some of the things that Kate was talking about earlier about layout and effects of layout, Actually, I would suggest that the vocabulary that we have developed over the past 400 years or so to try and talk about English language verse is every bit as adaptable and in some ways more useful than the languages that of other forms of visual media that we've developed to try to describe something like comics. There's a real tendency, for example, for students to fall into the language of cinema studies to talk about camera angles and so on. And I'm not averse to that, frankly. I mean, I think when trying to talk about comics, whatever descriptive vocabulary is helpful to you at the moment that you're using it is fine. But I have found that the language and vocabulary of poetry is every bit as helpful to try and really get some kind of understanding of what's happening on a comics page and how they operate as the language of film and television. I think that, and that can be a surprise perhaps sometimes to students, but it's rooted, I think, in the idea that you have a page where you have linear sequence, but you also have an experience of a kind of artistic whole, so that there is a relationship between sequence and surface, to use, again, I think Hatfield's terms. There's a relationship between our attention between sequence and surface that is fundamental to the short lyric poem and also to any given comics page. So maybe less of a jump than you imagine. And then actually most of my own work in comic studies has not been focused in nonfiction comics. One of the reasons I've learned so much from what Kate has been doing is because this isn't really the area where I've specialized. I've thought a lot about superhero comics over the last 10 years or so, and they have a lot more in common with other kinds of 16th and 17th century literature. You know, the Fairy Queen and the average Marvel epic, there really isn't that much of a jump. We're talking about characters who are fundamentally emblematic, who stand for things, who are allegorical figures that represent ideas and concepts as much as they represent individuals.
Right. Another one of your books is Do the Gods Wear Capes? Spirituality, right. Fantasy, and Superheroes.
Yeah. And that's where I was starting to piece together some of these connections for myself, I guess, for the first time. So yeah, I still am lucky in that I get to teach poetry and comics now as part of my own rotation through the curriculum here. It keeps my mind active to be able to move between these two ostensibly different kinds of communicative modes, because, you know, and to sort of, I'm struck by comparisons and connections all the time.
So Kate, your work appears in a number of publications and journals, including the Oxford Handbook of Comic Book Studies. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I mean, that was a really fun piece to write, just because I was asked to take on something conceptually simple, which is just page layout. And being the sort of scholar that I am, I decided that this could only possibly be done by bringing together queer Palestinian American and Haida artists in ways that would challenge what we think of as traditions of layout and how pages are laid out. So I really like that piece just because it focuses on artists that might otherwise not be your first thought when you're thinking about layout. I think most people might come up with something like Winsor McCay or, you know, these beautiful old practitioners and Little Nemo. Instead, I went with Leila Abdelrazak and Michael Nicol Yakalonis, who to me are really foundational in terms of how I think through these questions. So yeah, it's an honor to be in the Oxford Handbook of Comic Studies. And it is a pretty fun piece that just shows how you can actually approach comics from any number of vantages and then maybe shake things up at its core.
Well, layout is one of those things that are invisible to people, but are really key to storytelling visually. And Scott McCloud addresses it pretty directly in his book, Understanding Comics. But you've written quite a bit about Alison Bechdel, the author of the graphic memoirs, Fun Home and Are You My Mother?
Yeah. And I mean, I think one of the things that Bechtel does is challenge the kind of stability of layout by intentionally making things what we would call in comic studies either unstable or irregular. And so taking layout and then in a certain way queering it, taking that word back to its origins, meaning not straight. And so you have these layouts that are actually skewing the page as a kind of grid-like structure and thus creating possibilities for new stories and new narratives. So I really appreciate writing on Bechtel's work because I think I learn a lot from it, and I know my students really get a lot from these books that are always not quite what they appear to be. They look like books, they look like what my students said, books, and yet you open them and they give you something completely different and something that then makes you rethink what you thought you knew going into it. And her pages are like that as well, where you go into a page and you think it's going to go one way and then you wind up getting turned around in the midst of it. And so I think those are good ways that comics can challenge how we read and also how we see and just the way that we approach the world and its structures. I think for me, one of the most important parts of curating, which was itself a struggle, is trying to balance the difference between reading and seeing. And especially with Joe's work, Joe has this entire sequence in Palestine called Moderate Pressure Part 2, where the panels on a page-by-page basis become smaller and smaller, but they're still operating in a grid-like structure. So you start with a one-by-one page, and then you immediately start splintering. And by kind of the real thrall of the narrative arc, you're going to a page that has something like almost 20 panels in it. And the narrative, at the meantime, is following this man who was detained and held for questioning and really tortured for weeks on end. And in the meantime, the panel structure as a reader is giving you this sense of the claustrophobia, the discomfort, just the extreme angst that's going on in the character. As a reader, you're getting that just by the way that the panels are proliferating and getting smaller and smaller. And so how to put that on a wall so that someone kind of gets the effect of reading that was something that we questioned, like how many rows of pages can you put up before it just either overwhelms or looks like nothing. And I think actually the installation team, Joey Capodona and Kurt Neugebauer, did an incredible job of knowing how many pages you can put into a tier where people can still read it and still understand what's happening and who the players are, but at the same time get that full visual effect of like, oh my God, I feel like I'm in a cell and I feel like I'm getting strangled the more that I read it.
It's one of the fascinating and sometimes unexpected results of taking a narrative medium and either blowing segments of it up or taking original art that was designed for publication and putting it side by side or arranging it in such a way on a wall that it actually becomes a new artwork. And I think that that was one of the things that certainly that particular moment with Joe's work was one of the most exciting moments for us when we realized this is going to look like it was always meant to be shown this way, whereas in fact it was not conceived for this particular presentation at all. It's a sign, I think, of how certain effects of layout can be so compelling that, you know, the semiotics of the grid from a sufficient distance produce narrative effects when you can't see that closely what's going on in the panels. And of course, then you can move up closer to it and read it that way. It's a challenge of curating comics shows in that this is an art of the miniature in some ways. You know, very often the individual details of a single panel, you might have to get up very close to the work to see what they are. But it's proof, I think, of some of the theories that people like Charles Hatfield and Terry Gronstein and others have developed, that one of the unique things about the medium is that it is not just about sequence, it's also about the sort of the wholeness of the page. And some proof of that can come out when you see a show like this, and when you see that, when you see original pages gathered together, making their own new artworks simply out of the way they've been assembled.
Yeah, I was teaching Seyferi Barajta, one of Joe's books, and students were often reading it digitally because that's what they had access to. And then when I brought students to the museum, they saw the same two-page splash that they'd read. And finally, one of my students said, "Wait a sec, is that Bruegel?" And I was like, "Yeah, you can see that it's meant to actually look like and evoke a Bruegel landscape and a full, you know, Bruegel people going about their daily existence tableau. But you can't do that in the digital form." And they were just blown away. Like, they'd been reading it page by page. And when you see the pages together, you get that sense of the art, and you know that these are also artists who are thinking visually about the entire tableau, not just always a modular sort of piece by piece. In terms of the original pages, one of the other astonishing revelations from the show was just that on the other side, you have so many works that are now optimized for mobile phone reading. And so a lot of stuff on the nib has been, you know, compressed and put together so that you're reading it as a panel by panel scroll. So then actually getting to see Ben Passmore and Gerardo Alba and Tracy Chauhan's original pages, which are these full Bristol board, mm-hmm. you know, black ink compositions, that was astonishing because you actually get a sense of them having this whole spatial idea of their work. That then once it's, you know, once you're reading it on your phone in a little scroll, you lose that. So I just adored the possibility of getting to put their pages up and see how big they are, and also their line work and the way that someone like Gerardo is really using panels and has this great panel sense of where things should be on the page, and Ben as well, and Tracy as well. And then once they're on the nib, you kind of lose that whole page view and you get instead just the panel to panel progression, which definitely my students were all really struck by, is how different it is to read things digitally versus to see them in this original form.
In an odd way, this is occurring to me for the first time as you're speaking, Kate, but in an odd way, it's as if this digital moment has in some ways taken us back to the earliest days of the medium, because when comic strip artists were producing daily strips, you know, in the earliest days of the newspaper strip, those strips needed to be designed in ways that they could be fitted differently into different kinds of newspapers. You know, there's that whole run of Crazy Cat Sundays, which has a central image, which is in some printed versions and not in others. Strips were sometimes printed vertically rather than horizontally. There was the idea that you produced strips with a potentially detachable first panel in which you might want to discard depending on the needs of the editors for the different newspapers where they were syndicated.
You know, I wanted this exhibit to actually challenge what a museum can do and what it's really for. I want this show to be about changing people, not making them affirm the value. Like, you can't, these aren't works to be appraised at some sort of monetary or even cultural capital level. These are works to hopefully change the way that you approach work itself. And similarly, I hope that it makes people think about what a museum space can do, as Ben said, to really educate you about the world around you and to make you think about it not in a forceful way, but rather in a way that is engaged and meaningful.
In your little university town of Eugene, there's quite an active community of comics creators. Do you get a lot of interaction with them?
Kate, do you want to take that one?
I mean, I don't know how much of this I'm supposed to say, but I will simply say that it's one of the greatest communities of artists and just incredibly loving and warm and welcoming people. And during the symposium, when we had 8 of the artists from the Art of the News in town, Gerardo Alba offhandedly said, if we were in Mexico, you know, we would all go out to karaoke after this and just have a great time. And it just so happened that Mike and Laura Allred, who are two of the greatest comics artists and colorists in the world, were having a karaoke party here in Eugene. And we asked if it was okay to just, you know, bring eight artists by. And so we had this really incredible communal artist singing session. And it's one of the joys of working here in Eugene.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And my guests today have been Catherine Kelp-Stebbins and Benjamin Saunders, professors of comic studies at the University of Oregon, along with Sarah Merck, contributing editor at the graphic journalism website, The Nib. We've been talking about the exhibition, The Art of the News, which is on now at the Jordan Schnitzer Museum of Art in Eugene. Kate, Ben, Sarah, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
And for those listeners who might be interested in finding out more about comics studies and comics journalism, where's a good place to look?
Well, I would recommend starting with the NIB, actually. That seems like a pretty good place to begin. What would you say, Kate?
You can also go to the Jordan Schnitzer Museum of Art website, which currently hosts a site dedicated to the show with individual links to all of the artists' websites, as well as a series of interviews conducted by our students with all of the artists, as well as a virtual tour, which you can take through the exhibit. It's done by Matterport, so it's a 360 3D version of the exhibit with all of the works on view. So those are really great places to start, and we will soon have a digital edition of the catalog as well. So those are all good resources, and I mean, the NIB is definitely a great place to go, and Drawing the Times is another good one. That's where I would send someone first.
Well, we hope that everybody has been enjoying our special holiday programming for KBOO's end of the year membership drive. Before we go, I would like to remind all of our listeners that this community radio station needs your support, as our physical studios are remaining closed for the time being. To become a member of KBOO or to arrange for a donation of any size, please visit kboo.fm/give. You can also text KBOO to 44321. Or if you prefer, you can mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Again, the webpage is kboo.fm/give. On your mobile device, you can text KBOO to 44321. And of course, you can reach us by mail at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. You can find an archived version of the show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on Twitter @wordsandpicture.